This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. After the 2016 election, Republicans have their largest majority in the U.S. since 1928, controlling legislative chambers in 32 states and governor offices in 33. They also held both chambers of Congress and the presidency, despite losing the popular vote. So what explains this? In her new book, All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States, today's guest, Megan Winter, shows how, over the past couple of decades, the Democratic Party and left-leaning political establishment abandoned the states to focus on federal races. And for the average citizen, she says the fallout has been catastrophic. Republicans and their corporate donors have diminished employee protections and health care access, stopped action on the climate crisis, and passed extreme abortion restrictions. Voting rights are being dismantled, and the mildest gun safety measures are being blocked. Megan Winter takes a deep dive into what exactly happened. She also travels to Missouri, Florida, and Colorado to find out how Democrats and progressives lost and how they might win again. Megan Winter is a writer whose work has appeared in many publications, including The New York Times and Essence. Her new book is All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. And Megan Winter joins us from NPR Studios in New York City. Hi, Megan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for writing this very important book. You write that for years it has been an open secret in political circles that Democrats and progressive interest groups have prioritized federal candidates and policy at the expense of the states. When you decided to take a look at why this has happened, how did you go about it?
Yeah, I came to this topic in part because I had been covering abortion for national magazines for several years, and that brought me to state houses where I saw firsthand how anti-abortion groups were pushing this legislation on the state level. And just by being in those hearing rooms, I saw that during the same day, they would be discussing not only these abortion bills, but voting bills. They were discussing Medicaid expansion. They were discussing energy policy. So much was happening, and there weren't that many people there to cover it. There were a number of overworked, underpaid statehouse reporters, and there wasn't anyone from the national press. So that made me realize how much was happening on the state level. And I wanted to look at a number of issues, and I wanted to look at a few different states to show the patterns and trends and how this affects all of us, no matter what state we live in. You know, I live in New York. Your listeners, many of them live in California. But even still, even if we have a Democratic-controlled state where people pride themselves on their progressive politics, we're affected by laws and policies and politics happening in other states for a number of reasons, and I wanted to show that.
It's pretty incredible what you saw in Jefferson City, Missouri, when you were there on a Thursday afternoon in May 2016. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to get good coverage of all of these hearings, you would need probably a handful of reporters, because you said you were weighing whether to go to the Capitol basement for a meeting about the Senate holding a Planned Parenthood CEO in contempt, or go upstairs to listen to the House debate a bill that would have made all abortion illegal without an exception for the life of a woman. Also that week, the Assembly was debating and ultimately passed what would become the first Stand Your Ground gun law to take effect since Trayvon Martin was killed in 2012. So there's so many very important things happening in a short amount of time.
Yeah, exactly. I can't stress enough how much is happening in state houses and state capitals. And again, the American public, we don't have a way to know how much is happening there for a number of reasons. And before I talk about that, I also want to say libertarian and conservative and Republican strategists have decided to push their agenda and to build political power in the state houses and on the state level explicitly because they know, and they have known for years, that it's much harder for us to be aware of what's happening there. So this is a deliberate decision to have a state-based agenda. And again, it affects so many different issues. And there's wonderful local media out there, and then there's the national press, but there aren't enough platforms that describe the synchronized campaigns in a way that all of us across the country understand the significance of our local laws.
Even in here in California, where there's a lot of money, we're losing incredible media institutions and reporters are being laid off. So can you talk a little bit more about just how that is really affecting people's ability to stay informed about what's happening in their backyards?
Yeah, this is, you know, one of the terrible things about this era, and I wish I had a solution, but I don't, other than people supporting, you know, stations like yours and other forms of local media. State House reporters have, or I should put it this way, local newspapers and local radio stations, various forms of local media have, you know, it's been harder and harder for them to stay in business, to be reductive, because of the internet, because of after the financial crash in 2008, they continue to struggle. And what does that mean? That means it's much harder for local reporters to have the time to go report on these hearings. And what ends up happening is media companies have consolidated, and as they've consolidated, they've increasingly focused on national news. And you know, again, I'm going to oversimplify, and I'm sure listeners will know what I'm talking about. But so much of our national coverage of politics, it ends up being about the personalities of the presidential candidates,
exactly.
Because that's not expensive to produce. It's not laborious. It's not difficult. It's not the kind of, you know, for example, the Arielle, who you just had on the show earlier, she's giving a firsthand account of what's actually happening on the ground and giving context about, you know, farm workers and what a national story means to them on the ground. And those kinds of reports, it takes work to find someone like that who can report that way. And that's what journalism is. That's what journalism is supposed to be. But as the news media has consolidated, as the media has gone increasingly after engagement, because various social media platforms like Facebook provide a financial incentive to go after engagement rather than content, we increasingly find ourselves in a world where it's become a reality TV show, watching the news rather than understanding how government operates and how people who have incredible amounts of power, how they're wielding that power. We are less and less able to understand that in both a granular way and also in the broad strokes ways. So that's why I felt writing this book was so important, because I happened to be in these hearing rooms because I was assigned to cover the anti-abortion movement. And by virtue of seeing that, I came to see how much happens on the state level and how I had not had access to that information, even though I was someone who read the newspaper every day. So I hope that there's a way that going forward, you know, media outlets find a way to tell the American people what's happening on the state level. I can't say that I'm particularly hopeful at the moment.
You write that between 2004 and 2014, just as the right's coordinated campaigns in the states accelerated, local newspapers lost about a third of their full-time state house reporters. And one former state house reporter in Florida told you, quote, "No one has the luxury to spend all day in a hearing." And I'm really glad that you also wrote about popular podcasts, because you say that a lot of those are produced with political junkies in mind, and they're no better on this front. Week after week, we hear D.C. or New York-based journalists engage and circular self-righteous glee or concerned analysis about the Trump administration's various misdeeds. So we're really in a crisis here when it comes to making sure that we know what's happening at the local and state levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't emphasize that enough. And again, that's why shows like yours are important. It's why it's important for people to support local journalism. And something I've thought about quite a bit as well is, again, what happens on the state level is largely synchronized, and that's true on the right and the left. It's just that the right is better at what they do on the state level. And what do I mean by that? I mean that there's this cookie cutter legislation and it gets passed around. Listeners may be familiar with some of the anti-abortion bills that were making headlines in the spring. But this is also true on environmental policy, on union policy, on a whole number of issues. So what does that mean? That means to understand what's happening, you have to have a national perspective, but you also need to know what's happening locally. So even if I'm reading about a gun bill that was passed in Kentucky, for example, I might not understand the full consequence of what that means unless I know that it also happened in, and I'm, you know, making these states up, but, you know, Nevada, Missouri, Florida, what have you. So that's another issue, is that even if State House reporters are doing the best they can, they're just, based on our media structure, there's not a way to get a bird's eye view, which is really too bad. Because another thing that I think is really important that I did not understand until really finishing the book is that it's not only that these issues are being pushed on the state level, but they get their power from the local level. I mean, but what I mean by that is, it's not inevitable that some of these issues like abortion or guns would take on the significance that they've taken on in our politics, except that they excite and they motivate conservative or Republican voters, or they turn people into Republican voters when otherwise they might be Democrats. So you can't really understand the kind of cultural conversations that are happening or the rightward or leftward tilt of the country as a whole unless you understand how that's playing out on the local level.
We're going to take a quick break, and after the break, I'd love to talk with you about your chapter about progressive funding and conservative funding, and we'll just use those labels for now, but we know what we mm-hmm. mean. It's really, mm-hmm. really interesting what you wrote about. Megan Winter is the author of All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by Megan Winter, author of an important new book called All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Republicans, after the 2016 election, controlled legislative chambers in 32 states and governor's offices in 33. In her new book, Megan shows how, over the past couple of decades, the Democratic Party and left-leaning political establishment, and I should say the left-leaning political establishment, really abandoned the states to focus on federal races. Well, Republicans looked at the long game and they started funding various organizations. They would push candidates to sit on local school boards in very small towns, knowing that it would take decades to really build power. And sure enough, they have been incredibly successful. If you have a question or comment for Megan about her reporting, what she found, what are your thoughts about why the Democrats have focused more on the federal races than on local races? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Megan, I found the chapter about fundraising just fascinating. You say that a line that you heard from multiple people of different generations living in different states is you could write a whole book about the problems with progressive funders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is something that I also found fascinating. And we often hear this line like, oh, the right has more money. Oh, it's easier for them. And to a certain extent, that is true. You know, Republicans tend to have more corporate donors. As we all know, there are these major right-wing institutions like the Heritage Foundation, the Koch brothers run Americans for Prosperity. There are a number of institutions that have been pushing the rights agenda for decades, and they've been successful pretty successful. So why hasn't the left been able to have the same to build that same sort of infrastructure? And part of it, I discovered from talking to people and also looking at financial documents, looking at the histories of some of these organizations, is not necessarily that there aren't either centrist or left-leaning donors that are that it's not that those donors don't exist. It's that there's also a different incentive for giving if you are a Democrat or a progressive, and there's also a different sort of ethos or strategy or lack thereof among the liberal donors. And from what I heard from people, and it bears out if you look at the financial documents of nonprofits and also foundations, et cetera, is that donors on the left tend to think short term. They tend to be looking for something that they think is exciting or interesting or even charming is sort of a derisive word, but sort of something that kind of tickles their fancy. And why is that? Or, and Or it could be something that they're very, very strongly committed to and very passionate about, but it may not necessarily track onto a long-term plan to have liberal donors focus on, you know, let's say you assemble 50 left-leaning donors. What most interests them is not going to be necessarily unified. It may be some people care a lot about abortion rights. It may be some people care a lot about climate change. And maybe some people want to invest in parks, et cetera. Whereas the right, they have this unifying incentive to give, because when they give to politicians or organizing groups, they're literally going to get a return on investment. If they invest $1 million in electing a candidate or set of candidates who are going to reduce their taxes, over their lifetimes, they may get $1 billion back. Whereas on the left, liberal donors are cutting against their own financial interests quite often when they invest. So they tend to be more economically conservative than Democrats and progressives in general. I want to be clear about that because I think it's important. The liberal donors tend to be more economically conservative than the general Democratic population. And that creates that contributes to, it doesn't create, but it contributes to this world where we have interest groups that are representing certain special interests as having more sway and power and influence than some of the economically driven organizations. So that I found interesting. And then one last point, because I could talk about this forever. I also found it astounding how, well, a lot of this has to do with tax law that I'm not going to get into because I want to spare your listeners, although some of it is in broad strokes in the book. Foundations are not legally able to give to overtly political organizations, and centrist and left-leaning institutions, for example, like the Gates Foundation, let's say, they tend to stay away from funding anything that could have the whiff of advocacy or, you know, a political tint to it. So that means that we have all these direct service organizations that are being funded, which we can't criticize because that's good work. But it doesn't mean that there's been the same funding of political solutions to problems, whereas the right, their donors feel much more comfortable pushing funding for organizations that are trying to change the status quo and change the structures of our government and the structures of our civic life, whereas centrist and liberal donors may want to feed school children, like that may be something they want to do, but they don't want to change the status quo so that we have an economic and political system where we don't even have to have charities to feed children because people are guaranteed protections. So that I found really interesting, and I really encourage listeners, I mean, sure, buy my book, but if you don't want to do that, find some way to learn more about this, because I can't underscore its importance enough. And it's really crucial to understanding our current political situation, because we're used to talking about PACs and dark money, but foundations also steer our political conversations, but they're in ways that are invisible, frankly. And we think of foundations as these positive forces for good when they're really, I mean, to be totally frank, tax shelters for extremely wealthy families.
Wow. Well, to go on that point, you brought up the Gates Foundation, and as you point out, they own corporate bonds for Lockheed Martin and several major banks like Wells Fargo and Bank of America, and stock in hundreds of major companies, including a Chinese nuclear plant. You write, yes, this is how the world works. Expecting rich people to surrender all of their worldly possessions is ridiculous. But as you said, so is forgetting that these foundations serve as tax shelters, investment funds, and status symbols. And the Ford Foundation owns tens of millions of dollars worth of stock in companies like Walmart and Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's really important to remember that these foundations, And I, again, and just like as a caveat, like foundations is such a broad category that, of course, there's like small family foundations that do not participate in this kind of thing as much. And, you know, there's foundations is a giant category, just as a disclaimer. However, we have to keep in mind that these foundations are major drivers of capitalism. They belong in the capitalist system. They are run by people who have lobbied and protected the interests of extremely wealthy people. And I think we have to look at the world as it is and not how we wish it would be. And we have to come to realize that these foundations, centrist and left-leaning foundations, and frankly, any foundation that doesn't have a sort of right-wing bent, those organizations are not going to save us. They're not going to fund the kind of profound organizing and structural change that we will need to get through climate change, economic inequality, and all of the things that a lot of us really want to address and understand that it's life or death to address those issues. So what's the alternative is a lot of what I heard from people on the ground when reporting this book is we have to rely on organizations that are willing to take a stronger stance, that are looking for structural change, whether it's campaign finance reform or holding energy companies accountable or whatever it is. And a lot of those efforts, like for better or worse, are going to have to be volunteer driven or funded in different ways, because otherwise it's just not going to happen.
The other thing that you point out is organizations that are doing great work, and we've had so many on this show, have a really hard time staying afloat. So you point out the Foundation Source, for example, which advises foundations, found that in 2016, the average grant from an affiliated foundation with an endowment larger than $10 million was roughly $21,500. That's not even a salary for someone living in the Bay Area.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've worked at nonprofits. I'm sure listeners who've worked at nonprofits will recognize this problem. But it's really – so, okay, backing up. What I heard from people on the ground – and again, this bears out if you look at the financial disclosures of these organizations – donors on the right will sustain the same organizations for years, like years and years. That's why we've heard of them, like ALEC, the Heritage Foundation, et cetera. Those organizations, and this is common sense, but if you know that you're getting $100,000 every year from one donor or from one, set of donors, you can hire someone. You can lay out a plan for that year. You have more bandwidth and, multiply that time by a few hundred and you're ready to go for a decade. Whereas if you're trying to raise $5,000 or $10,000 at a time or $2,000 at a time, it's much harder to sustain yourself. And not only that, I heard, and I know how cynical this is going to sound and how callous, but I'm just going to report what I heard from a number of people who have been trying to sustain progressive organizing outfits for decades, is that a lot of these wealthy liberal donors, they like the feeling of going shopping. Like they like to be able to pick out which organization they want to fund. And that they lose that thrill if they're just writing a check every year to the same group. But unfortunately, I think for the better strategy would be to sustain local organizing efforts year after year that can build on themselves. So this kind of disposable strategy that the Democratic Party has also used to move into partisan politics, the Democratic Party also will build up these giant presidential or sometimes Senate races. And then the moment the election's over, win or lose, they pack up and fold up and go home. And they disband all of those staffers and they go back to D.C. or wherever they're from. So the idea being the left, Democrats, progressives, all of those people need to build long-term institutions, long-term organizations, and that can only happen, one, if we all show up long-term, and two, if, unfortunately, because of the reality of campaign finance, if donors are willing to fund organizing groups on the ground all of the time, and if we transition from these like short-term bursts of interest in electoral work right before the election.
This is amazing. You use Tom Steyer, who's a Bay Area billionaire, as one example here. And I'm just reading from Ad Age. From the start of Tom Steyer's campaign on July 9th, he has spent an astonishing $34.9 million on TV and radio ads, and another $8.6 million on Facebook ads. So we're talking about $43 million from Tom Steyer. And you report that Democratic leaders have asked Steyer to quiet down and put his energy elsewhere, but he hasn't listened. At the same time, you've got environmental groups across the country scrounging for dollars, and they could have used more of his help for lawsuits, to get their volunteers out, to help officials win races, for example.
Yeah, I think Steyer is the most flagrant example of a trend on the left. So Steyer is, I mean, on one hand, it's like he's easy to parody because it's such an extreme example. And I think there are, but he sort of represents, he represents what is motivating a lot. And I mean, I'm not him, so I can't really say what's motivating him. But it seems from the outside that he is motivated by one. I mean, I truly believe a, you know, a commitment and a desire to improve the world, and especially on climate, et cetera. But it's motivated also by ego and not necessarily a listening to what is best for a movement and for long-term strategizing. So that it's painful, actually, to hear about those millions of dollars, because what if he had spent, what if he, and what if he had gone around and found some friends and gotten together and decided, okay, let's go to Florida. Florida is a place, which I write about in the book, and I write about climate issues in particular there. It's a place where there's really bipartisan agreement that climate change is real, it's happening, and it's a threat to people's financial security and emotional well-being, et cetera. What if he had decided that he was going to build up a political apparatus over the next 5 years or so in Florida and organize people to vote out their state lawmakers who are appointing energy commissioners who are letting the utility companies do whatever they want in Florida, which is also happening across the country. So what if he'd built up a political movement there, which really is relatively inexpensive to do if you do it right? It's just, it's such a waste of money. Mm. And it, and again, Steyer is like the most flagrant, obvious example, but he, but that kind of, he represents something bigger that is happening on a much lesser degree with many more people. And generally, and I write about this in the book, it's one of the main themes of the book, is, and sometimes for good reason and sometimes not for good reason, Democrats have not sustained these kinds of organizations that just do the mundane, basic, extremely important work of having people go knock on their neighbors' doors when it's not an election season, and just have them talk to each other about what they care about, what's most important, what they want to push, what kind of messaging they think would bring in their friends and family to the electoral and the political process. Like, that kind of work, it may not be glamorous. It may not be the kind of thing, if you're a billionaire, you're going to tell your friends about it at a cocktail party and they're going to be impressed. But that's the kind of thing that has created social change in our country. Like, every example of social change that's happened, it's happened because of very sustained, concentrated work that is done by people on the ground.
Today, we're speaking with Megan Winter about her new book, All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. I think you make so many good points about how people are so focused on the national, like the Democrats, but also now citizens. I mean, a lot of people are so glued to the cable shows or Trump's latest scandal, but all of this happened before Trump. I mean, especially when we're talking about what happened in the 2010 election, when the Democrats really mm-hmm. lost so many seats across the country at the state levels. So what are you hearing from more progressive activists about the changes they're seeing on the ground? I mean, we'd love to have you back, because we're almost out of time, mm-hmm. to talk about the activists that you met in Missouri, Florida, and Colorado. And I got to say, Megan, when I read the section on Colorado, I thought, oh, four billionaires put their money together. I mean, this is just the world, the country we live in now. It's really all about money when it comes to politics. But four billionaires who were more progressives put their money together, and all of a sudden, all of these progressives started winning their races, including one of those billionaires. Or he's a millionaire, I believe. Jared Polis?
Polis.
He's the governor now of Colorado.
Yeah, I've been saying it. I'm like hesitant to hold Colorado out as an example because of exactly what you just said, which is that it did take wealthy people coming together to give Democrats a fighting chance, which is such a sad reality of our politics right now. But I do, one of the things, actually, you know, just leaping from the Steyer conversation, they did the opposite of what Steyer did, though. If you think about, I mean, right. On one hand, it's hopeful because they did the opposite, which is they were very committed to not making it about them. And they were very committed to doing what was pragmatic and on the local and state level. And they created these organizations that would exist beyond just the election season. So it wasn't only about winning elections. It was also about changing the cultural conversation, having a presence, cultivating talent so that people could actually get jobs, keep them, smart people would stick around and not just get disaffected or need to move to D.C. to be ambitious. So there's a lot that they did that was right. But yeah, unfortunately, money is such a driver in our politics. And until we have campaign finance reform, unfortunately, it's just a matter of how to wield money in ways that is strategic and for the long term.
You know, when Bernie was running in 2016, I get these dates wrong. 2016, yes. He made a point to say, you know, run for school board, run for city council. And a lot of people did. And we're seeing so many women of color winning their races. What are your thoughts on what we can expect in 2020? Again, I feel like so much of the attention is on who's running for Congress. But what really stands out for you when you look at the state and local activity across the country?
Yeah, so that's really an important point. And I just want to super quickly say, too, that in 2020, the state races are so important because of redistricting.
Right.
And in a majority of states, state legislatures will be the ones who are vetting and drawing and approving the district maps. And that affects all of us, no matter what state we live in. So if you want to make your money count, if you want to make your time count, focusing on the state races is a really big deal. So getting that plug out there, I do think things are changing in a number of ways on the ground, you know, since I began the book, even since it's been out. And a lot of that does have to do with this reinvigoration. I think that a lot of the there are more primary challengers running in across the country. People are really I've heard from a number of the activists from the voting rights groups, et cetera. People are really they're still showing up. They're still working. And I think it's frustrating that given how much is happening on the local level and how committed people are across the country, it is too bad that we don't hear more of those stories outside of our own. You know, we don't hear more of those stories, but it's absolutely true that on one hand, the effects of Bernie running are still being felt. For example, different state parties are refusing to take corporate money in some instances. Like Virginia is a really important race coming up in November. In just a few days, Virginia will decide its state legislature or vote on its state legislature. And that's an opportunity for Democrats to retake the Senate. And the Virginia Democratic Party recently announced it was not going to take money from utility energy companies, which is a huge coup because they were one of the biggest donors for decades, and they really controlled the energy policy in the state. So those kinds of changes where local activists are having an outsized influence because they're pushing the Democratic Party away from the corporate donors that have historically been its major donors, and a lot of these activists are younger, et cetera, and they're really changing the local conversation. And I think that will have ramifications for how money is spent going forward.
Well, Megan, thank you for writing this book. We'd love to have you back in the coming months to talk about what other races we should be watching.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Megan Winter is the author of All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.